we're all familiar with the story. If the simple story was how there are various characters who occupy a central point, Elimelech and Naomi. Elimelech was the wealthy person who was one of the leaders of the people, and they ran away with their children, two sons, to Moab because there was a hunger. He was very wealthy, but he didn't want the poor people troubling him in this crisis, and he wanted to save himself. So by his leaving, we could realize what kind of an atmosphere it brought about and how it destroyed the morale of all the people. Just picture, he was a leader and a wealthy person, a noble, and he decides to forsake them. Now, when they came to the cities of Moab, they married two daughters of the king of Moab, and Orpah and Ruth. Now, we know that later they played very important parts in Jewish history. Ruth, of course, is called the mother of the kingdom. Orpah, the contrary, as we know, went back and did not follow Naomi when she came back to Israel. And Orpah also had something to say about the future of the Jewish people, in an indirect way, because her descendant with Goliath, David against Goliath, it was the descendant of Ruth against the descendant of Orpah. It was all like in the family. And the two sons died. They both wanted to accompany their mother-in-law, Naomi, back. You know that she dissuaded one. The other one came back with her, Ruth, and Ruth then went to glean in the field. Boaz was one of the shoftim. He was a great, pious person, a very wealthy person. He was a judge, one of the shoftim. Boaz marries Ruth. His wife had just died when they came back. And from them came the Malchus Beis David, the house of the Beis David. So it seems that the beginning of Malchus Beis David, which began with Yehuda living with Tamar. That was one part of Malchus Beis David. The other part of Malchus Beis David came from the union of Boaz and Ruth. Now that itself is very intriguing. We'll discuss later why these types of origins were chosen, basically, from Malchus Beis David. So that has some type of a purpose or a message to it. Why did God choose these two ways? There's a number of midrashim here. The Alshuch, in his introduction, brings down the medrash in the following. He says, it's almost like a historical novel. So why was it written? Why was it necessary to write it and to include it in the Kisvei HaKedesh, in the holy writings? So it says, to teach you how much schar HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives, this is interesting, l'goyim lechasodim. Because Boaz saw the kindness and generosity of Ruth, that she has the midas achesed, and this is one of the three basic characteristics that are attributed to the children of Israel. They are rachmonim, merciful, baishonim, modest, and goyim lechasodim, and kind and compassionate. So Boaz saw that Ruth possessed all of these three attributes, characteristics, like he tells her later, it's been told to me the way you acted with your mother-in-law. And the Gemara depicts various acts that Ruth did, which convinced Boaz of her modesty and of her humility. All of this Boaz saw, and he recognized that indeed she is a paragon of virtue. And she perhaps, because the tradition has it, as we'll see later, that the elite of the people, the nobles of Klal Yisrael, knew through their knowledge, their greatness, that Melech HaMashiach would have to come from Moab, that Moab would also in one way contribute to Melech HaMashiach. In fact, the Alshich says that that's why one of the, a second reason why Avimelech went, why did he go, as by Yetzei Yish mi Beis Lechem Yehuda, the beginning, that Elimelech went to Zdei Moab. Why did Elimelech go to Zdei Moab? Because tradition tells us that in the days of the Mashiach, in the days of Malchus Beis David, there will be a great hunger. So he saw that there was a hunger. He also knew that the king of the Davidic dynasty would come from Moab, and he felt that he from Yehuda would be the proper family, be the progenitors of the Davidic dynasty. So he felt this was a divine omen, a sign that he should go to Moab. Perhaps he there would marry a woman and would have a child who would become Melech Beis David. So he held that it was proper for him to be the father of Malchus Beis David. So we know what happened, that he was condemned for doing this. But indirectly, he did contribute to Malchus Beis David. Why did he contribute? Well, you'll say it really wasn't a contribution because Ruth had no connection to him. I mean, Ruth married Boaz, so how does that come to Elimelech? She married Elimelech's child, Mahlon died. So where does the child come to Elimelech? So if the Auschwitz explains, if you look at the last few phrases in Ruth, it tells you the genealogy, the historical background of Malchus Beis David. But before that, it says in sentence 14, Manu Hanoshim El Nomi, blessed is the God who did not forsake from you a redeemer. His name will be called in Israel. And this will be to you a resurgence of life. That means it will give you back your life and it will sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law that you love so much gave birth to this child, and she's better to you than seven sons. So it says, Naomi then took the child, and she nursed the child. Now it says your daughter-in-law. We'll later speak of the relationship of Naomi, but even if it was her daughter-in-law, but Boaz is not her son. I mean, previous marriage, it was her daughter-in-law. What kind of a meshiv nefesh? How does this in any way help Naomi? So the Alshich on sentence 14 speaks out the following, because the purpose of Boaz marrying Ruth was, as we'll mention again, to fulfill later, to fulfill the law or the concept of the marriage of the Levirate. What is the marriage of the Levirate? The marriage of the Levirate is that when one brother dies without children, the other brother marries the widow. The idea of marrying the widow is, well, there's a mitzvah, of course, to do that, but it's also lehokim le'achav shem, in order to establish a name for the brother. The Ramban says the idea is that a person, when he lives in this world and he passes on, so his soul usually continues to live in the lives of his descendants, in the lives of his children. But in a case when he doesn't have any children, what happens with his soul? How does his soul continue to live on? So the Ramban says the idea is that the brother's soul hovers in his wife's body. And then when a child is born, it's like, when you say the same soul, but the soul of this child comes from the soul of the deceased. So that's an interesting thought of Yibum, that the brother's soul rests in the body. And therefore, the soul of the brother who is deceased continues to live. That's v'yikor ha'shem, not necessarily that you give him the same name as the deceased. That's not necessary. But spiritually, the soul continues to live in the life of the son that is born. So the Ramban says that this was practiced before the Torah was given. But not the whole idea of the brother, but the idea of the next of kin. If there was no brother, then the next of kin would do this. Now, once the Torah was given, the Torah limited it very strictly. It limited it to the fact that only a brother from the father who was living at that time can marry other relatives which were later incestuous relatives could not. But the Ramban says that it was still practiced by next of kin who were not forbidden according to the laws of the incestuous relationships. So that means a cousin, an uncle, or somebody that would be permitted to marry would step in and fulfill this concept of Yibum. So now, this is what we have here. In this sense, we have, well, Yehuda, of course, was a father-in-law, but the laws of the Torah were not relevant then. They weren't given then, so therefore he fulfilled Yibum with Tamar. Boaz fulfilled this Yibum with Ruth, because he was a cousin, father's cousin. So now that he fulfilled the Yibum with Ruth, so the child that was born would have within him the soul of Mahlon, one of the sons that was the previous husband. So the Auschwitz says, the women told Naomi, since Boaz is marrying your daughter-in-law for the mitzvah of Yibum, the spirit of Mahlon rests in the body of Ruth. And when Ruth conceived and had a son with the soul of Mahlon, she brought him back into another body. So the body was right from Ruth and Boaz, but the neshama was really from the neshama of Mahlon. So it comes out that Mahlon, the son of Naomi, Bola Olam, comes to the world. Therefore, the women said to Naomi, blessed is God that did not forsake from you a redeemer, because the child that was born to Ruth, he will redeem you in the sense that you will not be left also childless, and you will leave over a descendant or an heir, because Naomi also would have left the world childless. So he is the redeemer. Blessed is God who gave you this redeemer. So now, not only that, it was clearly the will of God, because the next day after he married Naomi, Boaz died. So it seems that he lived long enough to fulfill this mitzvah. Now, people then interpreted it in other ways, but we do see the design of God. We see the design of God in fact that Boaz had just lost his wife. Otherwise, he probably would never have thought of living with Ruth, but he had just lost his wife, and now he married Ruth. This was all the design of God, that the spirit of Machlon. We also see now, after they told this to Naomi, so Naomi was very happy. It says, your daughter-in-law, the emphasis in sentence 15 is your daughter-in-law that you loved gave birth to this, meaning if it was your daughter-in-law with the laws of Yibum, so actually it's the soul as a descendant of your son. And Naomi accepted this, and it said she nursed the child. Now, when you take this to the beginning, Elimelech, we just said, went out to Moab because he had an inspiration or a feeling that he would be the father of Mashiach, of Malchus Beis David, which will come with Mashiach at the end. So he felt that he's compelled to go to Moab. And then he died and his sons died, so it would seem that that's the end of the story. It's all over. But it's not, because really what he did was true. Because the fact that Mahlon married Ruth, and ultimately Boaz performed the law of the Levirate on Ruth and had a child, so that had the neshama of Mahlon, that came about because Elimelech went over into Moab. If he would have never gone, then Malchus Beis David would have never arisen. So, getting back to this Ruth, the Medrash says that the emphasis of Megillas Ruth, why was she zochah to this? To show us the Gomlei Chasodim, the person of Ruth, that Ruth herself was so great that Boaz saw in her character and he married her. So now it says, therefore Shmuel Hanavi, as I mentioned earlier, wrote this book, Ba'arichas HaMegillah Hazos. He wrote it in a long form, Lohodienu, to tell us, Mihu Ruth. Who is this Ruth? And how did this happen that Ruth should marry into Klal Yisrael? Who brought her here? So he went to the whole history of Ruth, and therefore the Megillah is called on the name of Ruth to tell us that the main substance of the story was because of Ruth. And at the end he says he follows the genealogy until David, because the Megillah was also written to show us how David was born from Ruth. And then he goes through what I said, all of these different ways. Now, David, we know, was born from Ruth, and that wasn't so simple. When David was born from Ruth, if you remember, when we learned the book of Shmuel, there was a question that Shaul asked, who is David? So right away they answered, David is someone who really is not only not an elite person, he goes, David is a person who comes from an illegitimate background. Why did he come from a legitimate background? Because his mother is a Moabite woman. But it says in the Torah that Lo Yove Amoni Umoavi Bikal Hashem, that a Moabite woman, you're not permitted to marry. She's allowed to become a convert, but the Moabites are one of the nations. Now, of course, that doesn't apply. We don't know who, but the Moabites are one of those nations that are not allowed to intermarry, even if they converted. They marry other people who had converted, but from the Kahal Hashem, they're not allowed. But actually, we say it was transmitted from Moshe. Moshe, it was the halacha that Moshe gave over the Klal Yisrael. The Torah Shabbat says, Amon Moab, but the Torah Shabbat Peh said that it does not refer to a woman. So, because Shmuel saw that the Iker HaHeter, Shel David, would be through this, he wrote this in, to be part of the Kisvei HaKodesh of the Holy Script, that it should forever be remembered that David was permitted to come b'Kahal Hashem, that he came from Ruth HaMoaviyah and she was permitted to be a member of Kahal Hashem. Now, we see even in the times later of Shmuel HaNavi and of David, there was still a problem with this halacha, with this law. It surely was a problem in the earlier period of history, in the time of Boaz, in the time of the Shoftim. In fact, we see later that Boaz himself had to publicize this, and the next of kin refused to accept it, because remember that Boaz offered the opportunity for the Goel, the Ploni, the other person who was a closer relationship, to perform this mitzvah, the act of the Levirate, with Ruth. So what does it say in chapters 4, sentence 6? So it says there, if the Goel says, I cannot do this. Why can't I do this? Because, let me just read that passage. Vayomer ha-Goel, lei uchal ligoli. I will not be able to redeem her for myself. Pen ashchis es nachlasi, lest I destroy my inheritance. Geol lecho atah, you go ahead and redeem, because I can't do it. So now there are questions, what does he mean that he couldn't do it? So one interpretation was, because I can't allow myself to take on a second wife and destroy the harmony of my home. Or another interpretation was that my merits are insufficient to redeem Mahlon's soul. But whatever the reason was, the simple meaning would be, I don't want to contaminate my children, because even if I will not die for the sin of marrying a Moabite woman, my children may suffer. He wouldn't accept the law that he was permitted to marry a Moabite woman. We'll relate to this a little bit later. So that brought about the idea of Boaz marrying Ruth, because he knew this law and he publicized this law. So therefore he ended up marrying Ruth and performing the mitzvah of the Levirate. Now this in essence is the story. Now there are a number of questions here. First question, the philosophical question would be, why to have Mashiach would it have to come both from Yehuda and Tamar, which in a sense wasn't the most perfect union, and also the most perfect surroundings, and also from Boaz and Ruth, a Moabite woman, and according to some, the child was conceived that night when Ruth was there with him. How could this possibly be that this is the way that Mashiach would come about? It's one major problem. Not a question only from Boaz to Ruth, it's also from Lot and his daughters. So it's also not the purest beginnings. It comes from incest. So you're planting the seed of Malchus Beis David in a bed of incest. So what luster could this add to the holy name? In the fact, Malchus Beis David personifies Melech HaMashiach. Then you have Yehuda and Tamar. Now she was presenting herself as a harlot. Yehuda didn't know that this was Tamar or a Levirate or whatever. I mean, he thought that this was a woman who was what she presented herself as being, posing as a harlot, and she lured him. But the Medrash tells us there that Yehuda sought to pass by Tamar. His inclination was to go by, but the angel of lust was like dispatched to him to waylay him. The angel said to Yehuda, where are you going? From where will the kings arise? From where will great men arise? Then he turned to her, by the way. He was coerced against his good sense. Doesn't mean that he heard the angel say that, but this was a terrible drive, perhaps in the subconscious. There was a terrible drive in Yehuda. So this apparently was an illicit manner. Not only that, it was not only divinely inspired, it was forced by the hand of God. So why did this happen? And then the next episode was the marriage of Ruth. Why a Moabite? People are going to always question it. Those that don't really accept the true meaning of the prohibition of Le'yove Amenu Moavi, they'll end up questioning the background of David very strongly. So it seems all of these instances we have this. Now why was this? Why did this happen? Sherech Hashem explains that evil exists and it has the ability to becloud the senses of the wisest of men in order to create a battleground for a man's struggle of free will so he could choose directly. People are rewarded when they prevail in a struggle to choose right over wrong. So the idea is, when you want to attack this Yetzer Hara, we spoke about this a few weeks ago, if you recall. We spoke about this when we recited the Ramban's interpretation of the Seir La'azazel. What do you do for the Seir La'azazel on Yom Kippur? It's not a sacrifice, but you send him like a bone. You throw a dog a bone so you could go by, so that you don't gather his attention. The Chafetz Chaim's interpretation, the Chafetz Chaim and HaTorah. So the idea is, a direct frontal attack on a Yetzer Hara is often doomed to failure. The powers of Satan are usually too great for mortal man. There are ways, however. The sages have an interesting expression, a bribe for Satan. A central part of Yom Kippur service in the Beis HaMikdash, Seir La'azazel, is explained as a bribe to Sutton, like we mentioned this before. To take the direct path would be to court failure by inviting the Sutton in all his ferocity to thwart the attainment of good. Sutton must be appeased. So the idea is like this, that the seeds had to come this way. It had to come. So why didn't Yehuda perform the mitzvah of the Levirate in a proper manner himself? There it is. It had to come in such a way where Sutton would be appeased. We're much too small to understand it. The philosophical approach that some of the people who claim that this is the beginning of the return, they say it was meant to be that way. And they bring you certain sources. But when you think into the Chafetz Chaim's here, the same idea would hold true there. Just picture, if there would go a few million religious Jews all of a sudden to Israel, perhaps the Sultan would wake up a little bit too quick. You wouldn't even get a foothold. So you go there, we'll say, not with a spirit of Kedusha. You go there just like to make a homeland as a natural way that people are entitled to a place. So the Sultan can't say anything about that. Rashi even agreed at that time. You can't do anything. But once you're there already, then God's way is that it could work itself into a higher degree of Kedusha and a higher degree of Kedusha. Now, this is one approach. Is it true or it's not? Who knows? In fact, that time when Boaz died the next day, right? So everybody would go around saying, Boaz fathered, see the Derech Hashem. It's a good thing he lived this extra day. But there were others that said no. They said, you see what happened to him? He shouldn't have married a Moabite woman. It was a desecration of God's name. Therefore, he died immediately. So the idea was, whatever happens, people, you could interpret in both ways. You have no idea. Now, was there any benefit that's going to come from Elimelech going to Moab? Some people would say, well, Elimelech went to Moab. Elimelech went, it must be God's will. What do you mean God's will? This guy goes ahead, he leaves Israel, he demoralizes the country. He's a wealthy person. He could have been there and led them in the time of need. And look what happened. He was punished that his sons died and so on. There can't be anything good coming from there. But we see that Malchus Beis David came from there. So the idea is that since God created the Sultan also, so you have to, there are certain ways that you're able to get by. You're able to get by, and you can never tell. We are too small, and we're only looking within the confines of a lifetime, one lifetime. So it's no way that we could really understand the importance and the significance of every act. And this is an important lesson from here. So this is one of the reasons how, as we say, he came out of murky water. We have to go according to the books. We have to go according to the laws. We can't go ahead. And this is a principle, and I believe. There's a medrash that says, Lu aisi azavu v'yester rasi shemoru. God will take care of the results. He told us to follow in this path, and we have to go. We can't say, well, I'm going to deviate here because Mashiach, I'm going to bring Mashiach. You can't bring Mashiach that way. You could only bring Mashiach by traveling in the confines of the Shulchan Aruch and doing what's expected to you, what you're supposed to do. But God himself uses both the power of good and the power of evil. God uses both in order to fulfill his purpose. We have to be part of the power of good. And we as human beings are told, you do the mitzvahs, you're the power of good. Now there are forces of evil in the world, but we can't join the forces of evil in order to bring about things that will happen in the future. This is one approach. There are other approaches. But even according to his approach, it gives us no license to go ahead and to join with the powers of Satan to help bring this about. Now, this is one question. The most interesting question, which I always find intriguing, is were they Jewish right away? Did they marry before they converted, or did they marry after they converted? What was this relationship? Difficult, extremely difficult, especially when you take the literal meaning of the word. Was the relationship one? There was a marriage that took place. So this marriage that took place, Machlon and Chilion, when they married Ruth and Orpah, there, if you go through gleaning the Chazal, you find many contradictory midrashim. In the beginning of the book, we read in sentence 4 and 5, we read there that Vayisu lehem noshim moavios, they dwelt there like 10 years, and Machlon and Chilion died. Now the Targum, which is the authentic interpretation, in Aramaic writes the following, that they transgressed the decrees of God. They took foreign women from the daughters of Moab. Name of one was Orpah and the second was Ruth. Ruth was the daughter of Eglon, who was the king of Moab. And because they transgressed the decree of God and they intermarried with the Moabite women,
So therefore, they were punished. And that's the opinion of the Medrash. They were punished for that. The Talmud in Bava Basra says the same idea, because they married Moabite women. So now it would seem that these women did not convert, but they were actually Moabite women. And there's another method from the text, also from the Targum, from the Gemara, says clearly, Lo gairum velo hitvilu also. They didn't convert, and they did not immerse them. In addition to that, we're bringing all the one sides, in addition to that, the Talmud learns out the basic laws of conversion from the book of Ruth. Example, when Ruth says to Naomi, Al tivki bi, do not urge me, do not push me, le'ozveich, to forsake you, lo'shuv me'acharoyech, to turn away from you. And then she says, where you will go, I will go. Where you will lodge, olim, I will lodge. Your people are my people, your God is my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. So should God do to me, and so should he continue to do more, that if anything except death will separate between us. This is a very powerful, powerful statement, and Ruth made this statement. And besides the beauty of the statement itself, but the Gemara learns out from each detail mentioned, they learn out a special law. For example, she says, don't tell me to leave you because I'm determined to convert. From there itself, that a person comes to convert, try to dissuade him. So then Naomi told her, and we learn out that when a person comes to convert, you have to acquaint him with various punishments of certain commandments and give him an opportunity to withdraw. And in this way, Naomi was testing Ruth's resolve. She wanted to know if she really meant it. So she said, we're forbidden to move on the Sabbath. We're not allowed to go out more than 2,000 cubits. Ruth tells her, where you go, I will go. 2,000 cubits, that's all I'll go. Then Naomi told her, we're not even allowed to lodge in the same house, a man and a woman at night, if they're not married. So she answers her, where you will lodge, I will lodge. Another interpretation, the Medrash says, when we live in a house, we have to have a mezuzah. So she says, where you live, I will live. Now, if you notice, the laws were just picked without any special significance. It was like a smattering of the various laws, this kind of a law, that kind of a law, just to give the person an understanding of the details that a person has to. And then the Gemara takes every phrase. She says, where you die, I will die. The Gemara says that, you know, we have laws that certain laws are punishable by death. So she says, I agree with that too. And from these phrases, they derive that before the person converts, you have to acquaint them with these laws. And the next phrase, Vatera kimi sametze, Vatech dal ledaber aleha. She stops speaking to her. Why? Because once you see that the convert is authentic, then you have to go out of your way to bring her closer to the Shekhinah, rather than seek to dissuade her once you're convinced of the authenticity. So it's being that the Talmud learns out all of these laws dealing with conversion from this discussion that ensued between Naomi and Ruth, that's another proof that she did not convert yet and they were on the way back to Israel. Now, if we say that, but it's still very difficult to comprehend how Machlon and Kilion, who were called the two Gedolei Hador, we find, they were among the leaders, should marry these women. Don't they realize the importance of the law? Boaz was the head of the Sanhedrin. He was the Tzadik Hador. Boaz, Achzon, he was the Tzadik Hador. And he knew that this woman wasn't married. If she wasn't married, what kind of a Levirate law is there? He came to redeem the soul of the dead husband, because that's what the idea of the Levirate is. The soul of the dead husband hovers over the body of his wife. They are connected, seeking a fulfillment in that he should leave a heritage to continue on in this world. So that's only if they were married. If the conversion was a conversion, then there is some meaning to the law of the Levirate. But if there was no such conversion, then what kind of a meaning is there to the, it's like a charade, it doesn't have anything to do, and yet it occupies an entire chapter, and Boaz is extolled. She didn't convert, why is she a mother-in-law? There's no marriage yet. Why does it call her her mother-in-law? So you have difficulties on both sides of the coin. If she did convert, why did she try to dissuade her? And so because of all of these reasons, there is a medrash brought down in the Bach, Bach quote the medrash, which says that they were converted, that Orpah and Ruth were converted before they were married. Because it says there that Reb Padas asked
the son of Reb Yossi, since Ruth was a proselyte, why didn't they call her by another Jewish name? He answered him, so have I heard, she did have another name.
And the name that she was called, Ruth, that was the name that they gave her at the time of the conversion. So according to this, it would seem that she did have another name. We don't know what the other name was. I think I did see nobody ever got the name of Ruth. But she was called Ruth. Now, what does the name Ruth mean? He says that this was a name given to her when she became Jewish. But actually, the word Ruth, the gematria, the equivalent of Ruth, is Resh Vav Tov, right? Now, Resh is 200, Tov is 400, Vav is 6. So you have 606, meaning up to the time of conversion, she had 7 mitzvahs, like all mankind. When she converted, she was accepting another 606 mitzvahs. So that's where really the name Ruth comes from. Now, there is a interpretation of interest from the Vilna Gaon. The Talmud actually tells us, in Brachos, the Talmud tells us that what is the meaning of Ruth? So it says that she merited to become the ancestress of David, Sherivu LaKodesh Baruch Hu, who really saturated God with his songs and praises. So the word Rivu, they interpret, is related to Ruth. So really, on that point, the question is, where do you see, if they call her Ruth, how does Ruth have to do with Rivu? They should have called her Shira. Shira is a nice Jewish name, meaning song. So why did they give her the name Ruth? So the Vilna Gaon answers that the true reason, really, Ruth was given because of the mitzvahs, like we just said, the 606 extra mitzvahs. But why did they have to call her Ruth? They could have called her Turu or Tur. That means there's any other 3 letters that are put together. Why did they pick only that the letters should be Resh, Vav, Sof? It could have picked Tof, Vav, Resh, or Vav, Resh, Sof. Why did they pick it that way? So on that, the Talmud says, because of David, Rivu, and Ruth, Ruth meaning saturated, by putting the Resh and Vav first, so that alludes to the fact that David came. The main purpose was not Rivu, because if that would have been the main purpose, they would have said Shira, and that would have alluded more to the songs of David. The main purpose was to imply that she converted, and there were 606 extra mitzvahs. But then they could have used the 606 figure in any way. Why did they pick it in Resh Vav Sof? In addition to that, they alluded to the fact that she would have a son or a descendant of David HaMelech. And actually, if you look at the name Ruth and you reverse it, you also have Tof Vav Resh, which is a dove, a little bird. And Ruth is compared, like we said, Prados Tovos, really, to a dove. So there's a lot of interpretations given to the term Ruth. Now, did they convert or they didn't convert? So getting back to that, the Medrash continued, that actually, like we're saying, they did convert. But there was some question to the conversion. But it says, Amcho Ami, Velekaya Velekai. There are a lot of warnings that she tried to dissuade her. And if she really converted, so why did she try to dissuade her now? What's all of this going on that the Talmud tells us is going back? So he contends the same thing, chas v'sholem, that they would marry without conversion. But they did convert. But the idea was there was a suspicion on the conversion. Did they convert because they wanted to marry them? And they were respectable people and so on, Ephrusim, dignitaries, or did they convert out of their true belief? So therefore, once they died, we saw the result. Orpah went back, Taka, to her original religion, and Ruth is told by Naomi, your sister-in-law has now returned to her God and her people. She has chosen the other way. And Ruth cleaved to her. So the idea returned, he says, that itself seems that she had been away, but she returned. And cleave means that you're here and you continue to cleave. So he says even the words used seem to depict that there was a conversion. So if there was a conversion, there's why I saw the name. It's a long medrash. So he said if she did convert and that was her name, what was she called before? So then that fits in. So he says before she was called Gilit, which is interesting because the word Gil has to do with Gila, with joy, too. But she had the name Gilis. So according to this medrash, the only place you find the name brought down, her original name, according to this, was Gilis, and it was converted to, when Mahlon married her, she was called Ruth. And then Orpah, before he married her, her name was Horpah, like I said. That's why later we find that from Horpah, because she reverted back to her original name. The Bach continues and he says that both, all of the Chazal are true according to him, that they did convert, but there was a big question as to the conversion. And therefore, you have to say that just like we find in the Rambam, where we find that Shlomo HaMelech and Shimshon married many strange women, it says. So the Rambam says, chas v'sholem, that they should do that. To quote Rambam in Yud Gimel Mehilchos B, he says, al yala al daitcha, don't think, he says, that Shimshon, who was the savior of Israel, or Shlomo HaMelech Yisrael, who was called the loved one of God, married women without conversion. But the secret of the matter was the following, that normally when a person comes to convert, you have to examine him to see if there was any ulterior motive, and perhaps it's in, for marriage and so on. If you don't find any ulterior motive, then you tell them the whole process and the procedure and try to dissuade them, and if they are not dissuaded easily, so then you accept her, and he quotes the passage from Ruth. This is the words of the Rambam. The Rambam says, therefore, in the time of Shlomo and that, the Beis Din did not want to accept Gerim. Why? Because Jews were running high, you know, they wouldn't accept any conversion. So even so, there were many people that did convert, although the formal official Beis Din would not accept them. But they took a Beis Din, which was not a formal Beis Din, and they converted. Now, they didn't say they weren't Jews, because legally they had undergone a conversion before a kosher Beis Din. But they were held like par, not totally. They had to convince them yet that they were Jews. And therefore the Rambam said, so since Shlomo HaMelech, being the king, got this ad hoc Beis Din together in order to convert these women, was something that was not suited for Shlomo to do. And everybody knows, he says, that the reason they married, they converted, was to marry the king, so it was considered as if they were not converted. And many of them, we learned later, when Shlomo HaMelech became old, it says many of them returned to their idolatrous practices. But formally, legally, they did convert. So therefore, they say this was the story. Mahlon and Chilion converted them in order to marry them. And this was known that this was that kind of a conversion. Therefore, Naomi really did not accept it totally, and therefore she tried now, when she had to leave, to dissuade them and to see if there was legitimacy and authenticity to the act of the conversion. And 50% she was right, because Ruth did come with her, and Orpah fell back to her previous circumstances and to her previous situation. What does this mean? Let me give you a little brief background on the laws of conversion in this sense. When you come to conversion, we've mentioned many times, there are three aspects of conversion. For a man, it was milah, tefillah, and what we call kabbalas mitzvahs.
And this is a little difficult. Now, Kabbalah's mitzvahs. This means the acceptance of mitzvah. Now, we would think, and the halacha remains, that you need all three of these points. If you don't have all the acts of conversion, especially Kabbalah's mitzvahs. Some say that if there weren't three people for the tefillah, it would also be okay. But the Kabbalah's mitzvahs, you need a true Beis Din for that. Yet we find the language of the Rambam brought down that if they did not notify the ger of the mitzvos, and they converted, although they were wrong in doing it, but the conversion is valid. And this has caused a lot of confusion. So what does this mean? That you don't even need Kabbalah's mitzvos. It seems to contradict the Rambam in the beginning and the Shulchan Aruch, which says you do need Kabbalah's mitzvos. So Rabbi Feinstein and others before him said there are two ideas. There's one idea that's saying, do you accept all the mitzvos of the Jewish people? That's called Kabbalah's mitzvos. But you didn't tell the person any mitzvos. Another idea is that you express and you teach before certain mitzvos that you can't teach all 613, but you take major mitzvos, minor mitzvos to get their acquiescence. This is the proper way. So the proper way for a conversion to be 100% effective would be what we call a ger tzedek, that the person is converting not for marriage, the person is converting not for position, the person converting not for wealth, but purely for his love of the faith. The person also underwent all the rituals before a proper Beis Din, means a Beis Din who is kosher as witnesses and so on. A Beis Din that's not a proper Beis Din is obviously has no validity to it. And that's why we speak of the conversions made by other sect parts of Judaism. That there are conversions which actually now, even in Washington, we have women, we call women rabbis, who are part of the Beis Din. And obviously, those conversions are invalid. But even a person is a male rabbi of a synagogue, but if he's a Mechalel Shabbos, like many are, then obviously he can't be a member of a Beis Din, he can't be a witness. So you have to have three kosher witnesses who have all the laws of kosher witnesses. Now, what happens if you didn't have the perfect conversion, meaning that the person really wanted to get married or she wanted to inherit $1 million some way, and that's why she converted. But there was a kosher Beis Din that converted her. They told her all the mitzvahs and so on. She is really considered a convert. I mean, if they did it that way, she is considered a convert. What would be if they converted her or him and they did not notify the mitzvos? But they told them, you accept all the mitzvos, 600? Yes. But they didn't teach him any individual mitzvos. You're not supposed to do that, but if they did it, the person is a convert. Legally, we look at them as converts, correct? But did they mean it or not? They may end up going back to idolatry at the end because they may not have been sincere. And then if they're not sincere, we could then question, was their sincerity originally in their conversion? Normally, you wouldn't question it. But if something happens later, and it shows they go back to their previous faith, maybe there was never a conversion to begin with. We would always judge it as a conversion. We always do that. We judge it as a conversion. It'll be up for God to tell us, if it was ever a conversion or not. But a lot of people don't want to marry into that because that's a problem. So now the question is, what was this case? So they say it was similar to the time of Shlomo HaMelech when all the wives that he married. Obviously, he married these women from strange countries because they wanted to marry him to become the queen of the world almost. But at the end, we know what they did was that they worshipped their gods and their idolatry. That's why it said when Shlomo became old, these women went back to their religions. So therefore, they were always looked upon differently, the wives that he married, because people doubted the authenticity and the sincerity of their conversion. So she says that this was the Zohar's opinion was that this is what happened here, or how to answer it, with Naomi. It happened here with Naomi that Mahlon and Chilion, they had a conversion. There were many Jews there. They weren't scholars, but you just need a Beis Din of three people who are kosher witnesses. So they did have tefillah, they did have immersion. They didn't know the mitzvahs. They didn't tell them the mitzvahs. There were like two weaknesses here. They didn't tell them the mitzvahs, and they took them, although they had an ulterior motive for conversion, but they accepted them anyway. Now, Naomi knew this. So that's why she tried to dissuade them. She says, look, you're going to come back to Israel now. Nobody there is going to marry you because they're going to question your conversion.
And even if they'll accept your conversion, they'll say a Moabite woman is not permitted even as a convert. Why don't you stay here in this country? There'll be men here who have also converted, and you'll be able to find someone. She didn't necessarily mean that they should go back to their previous faith. What she meant was stay in the community here, and you'll find other people that will actually, you know, marry. So they were still called daughters-in-law because a conversion was a conversion. Now, when she saw later that Ruth authentically meant to come with her, so that's when she started telling her the hodos mitzvos. She started telling her the mitzvos that you would have to know to have a proper conversion. If you say that, so all of the other questions become clear. She told her all the laws that one has to know, to really know if she's accepting it. She also, Boaz, felt there was a levirate law because it turned out that her conversion was, like he calls her, a very righteous woman. Her conversion was a legitimate conversion. Therefore, the marriage was, of course, legitimate. So therefore, the law of the levirate would apply. So basically, punishment, however, could have still accrued to Matan v'Chilion, because just like Shlomo HaMelech, they were dignitaries. They were what we call Ephrusim, the leaders of the people. So they should have shown a better example. So these were the ideas, and according to the Bach, that's how you're able to take both of these views, which seem to have basic ideas that are stained by the passage. They complement each other according to this Rambam. That's the way he interprets this question. So this is part of the discussion on these. The idea of the legality of the conversion, the idea of the Moabite women, and the idea of the Levirate law, how it's fulfilled by a stranger, are three of the central topics of this book, which have engendered a lot of discussion. Okay.